Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So Paola Badosa and Cameron Norrie are the champions of an Indian Wells tournament that has been held in October. And that is very indicative of the wild ride that 2021 has been. David and Matt are here alongside me. You watched these finals at two very different times of day. Matt and I were there live while David was in a deep, deep slumber and watched it all on catch-up this morning. Is that right, David?
I saw the first two sets of Badosa against Azarenka, basically because I completely got all my times wrong. I'd been hearing so many people talk about the Norrie final due to get underway at midnight that I completely forgotten that the women's final was going to be before that, which is a terrible error. And then you both alerted me to the fact that this is a good final at 3-2 in the first set. And I'm like, what final? Oh, crikey, that final. Oh, and then I turned it on. And I mean, I think it's rare that you turn on a match like that when somebody says, oh, this is good. And that it actually seems to kind of get better. And that's what happened in the first set of that match. And then I got to one set all and I'm going to bed at 9:30 most nights at the moment, and I slept like a baby, and then I woke up and watched the lot whilst trying to make the kids their breakfast, and then my daughter ended up watching the conclusion of Azarenka Badosa with me for the last three or four games and the tiebreak and everything, and you know, by the end of it, she was a Paola Badosa fan, simple as.
I love sleep, Matt, as we all know very much, but I don't know what's happened to David Law, or David Law 2.0 as we now know him, because I'm not sure even sleep would have been enough of an incentive for me to switch off that Badosa Azarenka match. Well, at any stage really, but certainly not with it poised at a set of piece. So doff of the cap to you, David, and your new sleep habits. But
thank you. You've been working on that for 14 years, haven't you, Catherine? And now you've managed to get me to do it.
I'm really proud
of
David.
You've gone too far, David. You've gone too far.
Not only are you sleeping, you're sleeping through great tennis matches. How are you doing this?
I'm sort of like Benjamin Button, aren't I? I'm kind of like my sleeping patterns going backwards.
I mean, great tennis match is probably an understatement. I mean, this is absolutely a strong contender for match of the year, right?
Oh, yeah. I know it's so hard when you see something that makes you feel like that did, and to put it into any fair context against matches that happened a while ago and you can't quite remember how maybe they made you feel. But certainly the first and third sets of that match stack up against anything.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a contender. I tweeted as much. I was so caught up in that match. I tweeted, this is a match of the year, isn't it? And most people seem to be agreeing with that. I then suddenly remembered that the US Open was basically 2 weeks of matches of the year. And there were certainly lots of contenders in that tournament. But this was right there with them, I think. Certainly the fact it was a final, there was so much on the line. That always helps, I think. But yeah, just it's sustained mind-blowing quality. It's drama from start to finish. It was sort of tug of war, both players bringing their best and responding to each other's best. The fact the result was in the balance right until the very end, I really felt for all the writers having to file on deadline, because I had absolutely no idea who was winning that match. And I think Most of all, I will remember the match for its intensity. I think that's a Azarenka trademark, isn't it? That she sort of built her career on that. That's kind of her mantra. She said after she beat Ostapenko in the semi-final, if you're going to beat me, you're going to have to beat me right to the very end. And you expect that from Azarenka. So when you face her, you have to match that intensity. You know, we've seen Serena do that so well over the years. And Badosa very much rose to that challenge, especially in the first set. I think the first three games took 20 minutes, and that really just set the tone. Long rallies, hard-fought, contested games, and just carried on. There was a slight dip from Badosa at the start of the second set. So impressive from Azarenka that after dropping the first set in sort of crushing style, really, on the tiebreak, she then kept her intensity up, and there was no dips from her. And then Badosa just rose again in the third set. It was an outstanding match.
Yeah, talk about doing it the hard way. I mean, the two sets that Badosa won, she did it in tiebreaks, and they were quite similar tiebreaks, weren't they? Because Badosa just came out the blocks and took, well, in the opening set tiebreak, she took a 4-love lead, I think, and then got pegged back. It ended up being a bit closer, and I think in the third set tiebreak, she took a 3-love lead, certainly. it ended up getting a little bit edgier as well. But, you know, in I think both of those tiebreak situations going into them, you'd back Azarenka. You'd back experience, I think. I think most people would anyway. But Badosa is gutsy, isn't she? She took the risks in the tie breaks, and she made Azarenka look a bit gun shy, really. She made Azarenka look, well, she made her play defensive. She made her, yeah, look like the shrinking violet on the court. I was so impressed with how Badosa took that match in the most pressured and tense of circumstances. And let's remember, completely uncharted territory for Paola Badosa. It would have been entirely understandable if she hadn't quite turned up for that match. You know, that, I mean, talk about a huge leap up for her in terms of achievement and experience and all of those things. And she didn't just show up. She showed up and showed us something she's never showed us before, I don't think. I was so, so impressed with not only her tennis, but her fangs in that final. And let's not forget that Azarenka served for the match in the deciding set. She had 30 love in that service game, and those 2 points at the start of it were won very quickly. It looked, I'm not going to say inevitable, but it looked, you know, the train had left the station. It was rolling. Yeah. And Badosa somehow managed to put the brakes on it. And wow, it was impressive.
Yeah, I kind of felt when the match was going on that Badosa was the more explosive of the two in the exchanges. That's despite the fact that Azarenka kept on bringing it, I didn't feel like she was not going for it. I just think that when the ball comes off the racket of Badosa, there's a real injection on it, and there's the spin and all the rest of it. She's kind of the full package from the baseline, I think. And I think what impressed me most about her was that she was having to find out about herself as the match was going along. And she played that incredible first set, and you saw the difference in their experience, the way Azarenka won the second set. But also wasn't really there in that second. She kind of blown herself out in that first set, whereas Azarenka's saying to her, well, yeah, but champions do this consistently, relentlessly, and that's what I'm going to do. Can you? And she couldn't in the second set. And it was, and then when they got into the third set, they were, oh, hello, Billie Jean. In the third set, they were straight back into toe-to-toe again. It was, Badosa was having to kind of ride the waves of the match in order to win it. And I sort of felt all the way through, I kind of felt she would win. But then when it was, when Azarenka had broken her serve and was serving for it, no, I agree. I mean, I didn't see the break coming again from her, and I just think she learnt about what it takes in the finals or at a Grand Slam. This wasn't a Grand Slam, but I think she will now be able to take this into future tournaments, and she now knows what it's like to live with somebody who has gone to depths of pushing yourself that only people like Azarenka have gone to in the game.
And Indian Wells has been a launch pad, hasn't it, in recent years. The 2018 winner was Naomi Osaka. She went on to win the US Open that year. Bianca Andreescu 2019 did the same thing. Obviously, there's no US Open for Paula Badosa to go on to win this year because of where Indian Wells has fallen. But
as did Dominic Thiem, of course.
Yes, absolutely. So there's certainly precedent there. And I think Badosa she's been building to this result. She's had a really interesting season. She started it at about 70 in the world. She's now up, I think, to 16 into the top eight in the race. And there have been some real high points and milestones. She won her first Grand Slam match in Australia this year. She beat Ash Barty in Charleston. She reached the semifinals in Madrid in front of that home crowd, which was a really big deal. She reached the second week at both Roland Garros and Wimbledon over the summer. And yet there's also been quite a lot of adversity in this season, sort of physical and mental. She began the year at 21 days hard quarantine in Melbourne.
And got COVID, I believe, and suffered quite badly from it as well.
She then had a real heartbreaking loss at the French Open, 9-7 in the third to Zidanec. She had to retire with heat stroke at the Olympics in the quarterfinals there, just a couple of matches away from getting a medal. She's changed her coach, as we spoke about last week. You know, so all of this has been going on, and yet she's maintained a consistency, and it has felt like she's been building to this result. So yeah, I'm so impressed. I think that trait you mentioned of her winning sets, tight sets, despite Azarenka playing well and coming back at her, was something that she had all week, really. She did it against Krejcikova. She did it against Kerber. She's so, so mentally tough. I think from Azarenka's perspective, I didn't see that break back coming either when she was 30 love up, serving for the title. I was reminded on Twitter by Matt Trollope that, yes, Azarenka won Cincinnati last year, but she didn't actually have to win that final because Naomi Osaka withdrew beforehand. It had actually been 5 years since Azarenka had served out a title. Miami 2016 was the last time she had to do that. And you do hear old, you know, sort of legends of the game talk about what changes as you get older and is it your nerve a little bit? And I think a lot of them do say that. And you know, perhaps just that was significant. Azarenka not having been in that position recently, she did get tight. The double fault came. She did start missing. I think she lost 8 of 9 points in a row from that 30 love moment. So she did let it slip a little bit. But once it got to the tiebreak, it was all about how brilliant Badosa was and how she rose to that challenge. And yeah, injected pace into her shots. It's really noticeable that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Badosa might have been partially motivated by a desire not to be upstaged by her boyfriend's arms. Her boyfriend was very demonstrative courtside. Apparently he's a model, never seen him before in my life. Rocked up wearing what I would describe as lounge/pyjama wear. Or gym wear. Gym wear it was what he was wearing. A flimsy vest. He's clearly spent some time in the sun and in the gym, and the camera was on him a lot, and there was a lot of arm flexing, and I reckon she thought, no, this is not about my boyfriend's arms. This is about me. I'm going to have to win the title to upstage those arms, and she did. Well done her.
She sure did.
And she was wearing the Nike kit that Emma Raducanu won the US Open in. That is a successful kit.
Maybe that's the key to success. Who knows? In terms of the point about Indian Wells being a springboard is a really interesting one, isn't it? Because there is a lot of data and evidence and recent data and evidence to back that up. And this discussion will apply to Cam Norrie as well. What we don't have is any data and evidence of what winning an Indian Wells title in October means for anyone. Does this title kind of take the place of titles like Wuhan and Beijing and Shanghai in our minds and in the narrative, and Paris, where we think that's brilliant. And it's very easy to fall into the trap of thinking, okay, well, that person's definitely going to be a contender in Australia and for next season then. And actually it turns out being the worst time of the year to win a title. See Sabalenka in seasons past and Caroline Garcia as well. And there are plenty of other examples. I mean, I know the answer to this is we don't know because it's never happened before. But would anybody care to speculate? Hands up, please. Yep, David has it. I've just realised hands up doesn't work on a podcast. David, off you go.
I just did as I was told. I think it is different. I think the surface being slow, high bouncing, they did not make it look like a slow court at all, those two. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, okay, Azarenka won a very one-sided set and she hit 48 winners to 44 of Badosa. But like I say, I still stand by the fact that in those two sets that Badosa won, she was the more explosive player. That feels like a very transferable game that she's got. And I know it's quicker in Australia, but I think she has a really good game for the Australian Open, personally.
I'm not doubting the game at all, just like I didn't, you know, same applied to Sabalenka and Garcia and all of that. I'm just saying, is it a bad time of year to have to be playing
so.
Your best tennis?
There's enough of a gap for now. I think this is maybe a bit earlier in the year. I'm not exactly sure of the dates. Look, I may be completely wrong, but I just think her game looks so solid in its foundations. And she seems mature as well because she's gone through a lot. She's spoken a lot about the depression she suffered after her junior years and how I think she's kind of really got to know herself in that period and come out of it as a very solid character. And just, it's just a feeling. I think that this is a player who we're just going to keep seeing in quarterfinals, in second weeks of Grand Slams and pushing. I think she's in the mix as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with everything you've just said, David. I just feel like you've answered a slightly different question to the one I asked.
Well, I don't see any problems with the time of year for her. I don't.
I think it's interesting with the WTA finals around the corner. You know, that is an event you want to be heading into with good form, and it's looking like she will now qualify. That isn't certain. Certainly if Ash Barty does play, then there's a lot still to play for in terms of qualification. If Ash Barty sits it out, we know she's back in Australia, then I think Badosa is in and she's heading into that tournament with form. Again, the conditions there will be a factor, so we understand.
We don't know what kind of factor.
No, we just think there
will be. A fun factor.
And they might help some and they might hinder some. Who knows whether it will help or hinder Badosa. But I think it doesn't feel like this has just come out of the blue and now this is, let's see if this is a launch pad for her. As I said, it feels like she's been building to this result and this is a step for her on her trajectory, I think, pretty much right to the top of the game. I really have belief in Badosa. I've enjoyed watching her play this year and she seems to have the physical capability, she seems to have the game and she seems to have the mental strength required to win big matches.
And I think obviously winning this title will enhance all of that. But I, listening to her speech yesterday, and both speeches were an absolute joy from Azarenka and Badosa. But listening to Badosa's speech, I do think beating Azarenka in this final will be particularly significant for her in terms of belief, because she spoke so heartfeltly, not a word, about how much of an inspiration Azarenka was to her at a very critical, I mean, it must have made Azarenka feel 100 years old, but at a very critical time in her development, sort of in her mid-teens, she said to her coach, I want to play like her. I want to win titles like her. So Wow.
I didn't see that.
Be playing like her and winning titles like her, but also doing it against her. I don't know. That's got to be something big. I think so. Yeah, I totally agree. This isn't out of the blue. This is okay. It's a big step up, but it's a continuation of the curve that she's been on, and I do think she's here to stay. I just worry that it's the wrong time of the. It's such a frustrating time of the year to build momentum. And you must have that feeling of, God, I just want the season. Why can't the Australian Open be now? I don't want Christmas. I don't want to take a holiday. I want to carry on playing tennis. But yeah, I could be wrong. And I hope she is able to continue it, because she's good news. She's great to watch. And hey, it's great to see Azarenka playing good tennis as well, and giving also a brilliant speech. So that was the first final that we saw yesterday. I think the longest ever women's final in Indian Wells, and it caused the men's final to be slightly delayed coming onto court. But come onto court they did. Cameron Norrie and Nicolas Basilashvili of Georgia. And this was also a three-set final, but one with a very different feel about it, I think, Matt.
Yeah.
Or David. I should have done hands up again, shouldn't I? Who wants to go?
Go on, David. You take it.
Well, I mean, the thing that struck me is that the difference between the two finals is in the women's final, they both played well at the same time. And in the men's final, they didn't. It really comes down to that. Norrie had a spurt for 3-1. Then he watched as his opponent just played like out of his mind and won the first set in 29 minutes from 3-1 down. And then went to break up in the second, and then completely went off the boil to an embarrassing level. I mean, he was suddenly hitting forehands 10 feet long, halfway up the net, missing the sort of tram lines. You know, he couldn't. It's bizarre how you can go from being that good to that awful in the space of a few shots. But then when you're hitting average speeds of your ground strokes 10 miles an hour faster than your opponent, and 83 off one side and 85 miles an hour off the other side, you're not giving yourself much margin for error. So he had his moment, and then Norrie kind of took over with his relentlessness. But it wasn't a great final, but like the first one was. And yeah, just an amazing achievement from Norrie. And wow, I can't believe what he's done really this year.
Yeah, it was a bit of a flat start, wasn't it? Because the crowd was very sparse. You know, it was a brilliant crowd for the women's final, and then understandably lots of them want a break from the sun, I think, and then they left, and Norrie and Basilashvili came out, and it was pretty empty to begin with. And yeah, I completely agree with David. It wasn't a classic match, because they didn't play well at the same time. There was a moment of absolute brilliance from Cameron Norrie at 5-4 in the second set with Basilashvili serving. The 2 points he played to start that game, the first was a drop shot lob drop shot combination to win the point, and then the second was a running backhand pass up the line, and just two moments of inspiration, and from then on he was the only one in it, really. I mean, I think Basilashvili only won one more game. I can't believe Cameron Norrie has won Indian Wells. I mean,
it's bonkers, isn't it? It's a joke, to borrow a Tim Henman-ism.
Yeah, and I think there's obviously going to be sort of comparison with Raducanu winning the US Open, just purely on the point of their two unexpected British tennis achievements that have taken place in the last 6 weeks. But they're unexpected for different reasons. And I think those reasons sort of influence the way I feel about them. Because with Raducanu, the thing which made it so astounding that she won the US Open was her complete lack of experience, you know, with it being just her second Grand Slam tournament. So there was, you know, throughout that whole 2 weeks, there was nothing at all to tell us that she could win the US Open. But other than the sort of history of no qualifier having done it, there was nothing that we knew about her telling us that she couldn't either. So we were sort of finding out with her and what her potential was and discovering all that at the same time she was. And that made it tremendously exciting and this kind of wild, unbelievable ride. And it was sort of really joyous. I think with Norrie, the difference is he is experienced. He is established. This is his fifth year on tour. And he's never done it at this level before. So there was nothing telling us he could do it, but there actually was something telling us that he couldn't do it. You know, we'd seen him improve, absolutely. We've seen him get better this year. But he's always eventually run into Berrettini in the Queen's final or Ruud the other week in the final, who just have a bit too much game for him. Or he hasn't always delivered his best in the finals. So the fact he's overcome sort of all of that, all of his own history, just leaves me with this incredible feeling of respect and admiration for what he's done. He's turned himself into a tennis player achieving things that I didn't think were possible for him. And I'm always wary of patronizing him with words like maximizer and consistent and week in, week out. And
unsexy words, Matt.
And those are the words which underpin his success, absolutely. And without all of that, he wouldn't be where he is. But he's also a very, very good tennis player. And I really tried to identify that this week and look at what it was. And I think especially against Schwartzman and against Dimitrov, those were two of the best matches I've seen him play. The forehand is loopy and spinny and the backhand is so flat and skids through the court. And I think that combination is really difficult for players to play against. And of course, he's got this incredible sort of depth on his shots and he neutralizes opponents and he moves well. There are so many great aspects to his tennis as well, which I think really flourished this week.
I will compensate for your unsexy compliments of Cameron Norrie with a one that will definitely be accused of being hyperbolous, and that is Nadal-like. And I think Dimitrov in the semis and Basilashvili in the finals, those two opponents were the perfect contrasts, really, to highlight exactly what is so brilliant and special about Cameron Norrie, because they're both flaky, aren't they? I mean, Basilashvili showed up for portions of that final and then, as you described, David, in vivid colour, went completely off the boil. And Cam Norrie was completely prepared for that. He knew that there was going to be at least a period of that game where he was blasted off the court by Basilashvili. You know, the difference in weight of shot at moments was staggering. Actually made Cameron Norrie look like he was, you know, playing badminton while Basilashvili was, you know, just, I don't know, playing lunar tennis.
And it was a bit like that in the Queen's final, really, I felt. And this was, I kind of felt this was Norrie stepping out of the imposter syndrome a little bit in that way.
Yeah, and obviously the matchup against Dimitrov, a really different one, but Dimitrov really played a terrible match in that semi-final. He did. He really failed to sort of follow through on the wins he'd had up until that point, which were great wins, but it was a poor performance from him in the semi-final. And you just knew before that match that was a risk, that Dimitrov wouldn't really show up. And you knew with Cam Norrie that there was no risk of that at all. He was going to show up. He might get outplayed if Dimitrov played his top level, but he was going to show up and do what he does. And he was going to do it every single point of the match. I don't think there are many players, and I'm not saying he is the Nadal level of this, because Nadal does this better than any other person in sport, I believe. But it is Nadal-like, the way he plays every single point, as if everything that's gone before it simply didn't happen. And that is a staggering, staggering compliment. It's as big a compliment as I can pay someone, really. It's incredible. And I know it leads to him being, you know, his celebration when he won was muted, wasn't it? He's so level-headed and seemingly unflappable that it's hard to get sort of great reaction from him, isn't it? But it was all so Cameron Norrie, you know, and that for me is what's played as big a part as anything else in getting him to this point. And I can't think of many players. Obviously, there's Rafa in a stratosphere of his own, but I can't think of many other players that are able to do that the way he can.
And it's interesting you mentioned Nadal, because I remember very clearly at the start of the year when Rafa Nadal played Cameron Norrie at the Australian Open, and we weren't sure what sort of form Nadal was in. Do you remember there was a lot of talk about his back being injured, and he'd won his first two matches, but he said before playing Norrie, I really need to step it up now in this third round, because Norrie is a different caliber of opponent. And it strikes me now that maybe Nadal did see something in Norrie that we didn't, you know, because he was aware that he needed to really raise his game to beat Norrie, because I think of this point in, point out intensity and consistency that he brings. And he did, and Nadal won that match in straight sets, and he then beat him again in Roland Garros, I think, in the same round. And then Norrie lost to Federer at Wimbledon in the third round. And it suddenly struck me that he's done all this, Cameron Norrie, without really having a Grand Slam run this season, you know, because he's run up against those players. And if there was one bad portion of the season he had, it was Cincinnati, Canada, US Open, where he played Carlos Alcaraz in the first round and lost there. And I think that just speaks to the way he's brought it all year, really. You know, I think this was his sixth final of the year, was it? That's staggering for Cameron Norrie. Mm. And yeah, I do think there is a Nadal-like quality, both within the match and within sort of the whole season as well.
And the other thing is that Norrie saw it in himself. There is a clip that's been circulating pretty widely on social media of an interview that the ATP, I think, did with him at the start of the season, sort of looking ahead, talking about the tour, not just himself, but about the tour in general. And he's asked, you know, of his peers, who do you think is going to have a breakout season in 2021? And I can't believe he manages to say this without sounding like a douchebag, but props to Cameron Norrie, he achieves this. He says himself, he says, you know, I don't want to sound like that guy, but I really think that I'm going to have a breakout season. And yeah, you have had a breakout season, Cam Norrie. It's
even
incredible.
Exceeding his own expectations, even better than what I think he hoped for, which I think is particularly impressive. And I mean, look, the other thing is he did this, he kept his composure in this final despite all this palaver over his shoes. I mean, he got his shoes stolen the night before.
I'm so over shoe drama. I'm so disappointed we're having to talk about this. Go on, just get it over with, David. Tell the listeners, we'll move on.
He didn't put them under a car. He stuck them on top of his locker.
Just put them in a safe place.
Why would you not put them in your locker?
I don't know. Maybe it's not big enough. Who knows? But actually, I think that this was a real problem for him, because he is on the eve of the biggest match of his entire career. And suddenly the three pairs of shoes that he's got have all gone. And he's got to put on a brand new pair and break them in and try and feel comfortable. And he was stressed about it. He said that, you know, he did feel anxious about it. And his coach, Facundo Lugones, he said, he did a press conference after the final as well. And he said, you know, in the past, he'd have used that as an excuse. He'd have been more comfortable sort of saying that was a big problem and, you know, sort of being all right with it. And this, he said, to be honest, I was more pissed off than he was. I was charging around the locker room looking for these things, and we had everybody in the team trying to find them. And he said, so in the end, we had to go out onto the practice court and really push him and move him around to try to get him comfortable in these new shoes. And he said, and he wasn't, because if you look at him in the first couple of games, he said, he was falling over. He was stumbling. He wasn't ready. And then there was a moment when Norrie, and I think this showed his experience and how he's kind of come to terms with his place in the sport a little bit and how much he wants it. He just made a conscious decision not to let it bother him anymore, to just accept the hand he's been dealt and play. And that's kind of what he did. He took it all in his stride, and he took the knockbacks of these balls flying past him and all the rest of it, and just got on with it. And some of those are the finals, and they both said in the press conferences he's had some bad losses this year. I mean, just a week ago or 2 weeks ago in San Diego, he's got absolutely hammered by Casper Ruud. It was an embarrassing final. He said it was his worst match of the year. I mean, Ruud played well, but that was as bad as he's played all year. We were talking yesterday about some of the matches we've seen him play where he's just been terrible in the last few years. In amongst a good career, you know, he's had a good career, but he'll sometimes have an absolute howler. But he bounces back. I mean, you use that Nadal-like comparison. In that way, that's what he is. He doesn't dramatize these moments. He just gets on with it. And then, by the way, just on the coach, Facundo Lagones, who he was a teammate of at college, and who's only 29 years of age himself and has been his coach for 5 years, he said, I've got a chip on my shoulder as a coach, in that I feel like I've got to work harder than every other coach to prove myself, because I don't have the experience as a coach. I don't have any past sort of record and reputation. I'm not a former player of any note whatsoever. So I've got this chip on my shoulder. And what a combination they've become. They both play as if they've got this sort of very healthy chip on their shoulder. And I mean, just amazing. Just brilliant.
I remember Greg Rozetsky once on Prime Video talking really insightfully about how much of an asset and a weapon it can be for a tennis player to have a chip on their shoulder. If you channel it in the right way, it can be rocket boosters.
Greg always had a chip on his shoulder as a player, and I really believe I can understand that. I can see where he's coming from. He got more out of his sort of skill set because of that as well. And actually, something that Norrie said about what he likes about the British players this year is that they've all stayed out on the tour all year grinding. And if you look at them, Dan Evans, Liam Brody, Andy Murray, you know, they just haven't stopped, him and as well. They haven't gone home for creature comforts. They've just kept out there. And that's made a big difference, I think.
Mm. While the men's final wasn't a classic, there were some stunning matches, weren't there, in the lead-up to that point. You had Dimitrov beating Hubert Hurkacz 7-6 in the third, in the quarterfinals, backing up his big win over Daniil Medvedev in the previous match. That was a heck of a win from Dimitrov over Hurkacz. Very, very difficult emotional time for me watching that match. There was Taylor Fritz beating Alexander Zverev in probably the match of the week on the men's side, I would say. Zverev had two match points, didn't he? There was a crowd shushing moment in amongst the whole thing. Taylor Fritz comes back and wins it in a deciding set tiebreak, and the whole thing is just lapped up by the Californian crowd. It was a really, really electric match, wasn't it?
Yeah, Fritz was really good actually to hang in there, and it was like the lights went out in Zverev towards the end, and he was talking afterwards about really wanting to just go home. And I think he's been out in America for a long time now. And Fritz rates himself and showed that there's reason to rate himself in that match, because he kept bringing it. And I mean, he was overjoyed afterwards. But I can't help thinking that that's a disappointing loss in the semis, that he didn't back it up and go and beat Basilashvili. He should have. In my opinion, he should have. I know Basilashvili hits the living daylights out of the thing, but he still should have beaten him.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he played quite well, Fritz. but he did catch Basilashvili on one of his good days. My main takeaway from Fritz Zverev, as great as Fritz was, well, the double faults came back and all the serving issues came back for Zverev, which we've not seen for a little while. You know, as soon as he got in that winning position and as soon as it got tight, he couldn't rely on his serve. I think he missed six first serves in a row. His second serve was either a really slow one, a really fast one, or a double fault. You know, there was absolutely no reliability to it whatsoever. And I think that's plagued him in the past, and it hasn't recently, but it's obviously still there.
And Fritz knew it was still there. And when it got tight on the return, he played with him a little bit with his return position. He went old sort of Sabatini and moved around and just probed at the chink in the armor, and players are going to do that.
Yeah, no, totally. Just one sort of big picture takeaway from this Indian Wells in terms of just what it says about where men's tennis is at the moment, perhaps. I noticed we've had four hard court Masters events this year, and all of them haven't had Djokovic, Nadal, or Federer. And the winners were number 37, Hubert Hurkacz, number 2, Medvedev, number 5, Zverev, and number 26, Cameron Norrie in Indian Wells this week. So, you know, that's an even split between winners you would expect and surprise winners, I suppose. And I think that's quite a good indicator of what this next phase of men's tennis is going to look like. I think the players we expect will still win the majority, probably, of the events. You know, certainly if you branch out and look at the clay court Masters this year, they have gone to players we would expect, and probably spread fairly evenly between those players. But I think they just are going to be more surprise winners moving forward over the next few years. We've got so used to four players kind of winning everything and not leaving that much to everyone else and being so good every single week. I just don't know if it's realistic to expect that from this next group of players, as good as they are. Probably also notable that the ones with surprise winners were the sort of isolated events, not really leading to anything. Miami was sort of just on its own this year, and Indian Wells was post-US Open. When it was US Open time, Medvedev, Zverev stepped up and won the Masters event. So there's probably something to be said for that as well. But I think we are going to get more Cameron Norries over the next few years. And players of his caliber, the consistently good players on tour, capitalising on a week like this and winning. Just something we haven't really seen in men's tennis that much over the last decade or so.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
He's 10th in the race, Cameron Norrie. We expect 9th place to be good enough to get into the field for Turin, because we don't expect Rafael Nadal to play in Turin. He is less than 200 points behind Hubert Hurkacz in 9th place, and there's 200 points between him and Jannik Sinner in 11th place. Is he going to qualify for Turin?
I would have said no. And then I heard Cameron Norrie's press conference, and he was asked about the events that he's got coming up that he's going to play. And he's going to play Vienna, Paris and Stockholm. Now, to me, I don't think those are great fits for him personally. I don't sort of think of Cameron Norrie as an indoor player, really. I kind of like the idea of him having elements. I think his game is very safe in elements. It doesn't matter whether you put wind or heat or gritty hard courts or whatever else it is, he will fight through them and be a presence. Put the conditions down perfectly, and I kind of feel like Hubert Hurkacz would have a more precise game, that Jannik Sinner's big hitting will hurt and Norrie's won't. But Norrie seems very unperturbed by any of it. He said, look, I like the courts in these tournaments. He says, I've never had a deep run, but basically I keep losing close matches whenever I played them. So if we've learnt anything, his self-belief, his self-confidence, and now his game to match, well, why can't he do it? I mean, he's so close now. And he's also keeps coming up with different terms of phrases that we might have to start using, like in the hunt and in the conversation, to go within the mix. I'm not quite sure how they differ. But is he going to make it?
We're a podcast. Everyone's in the conversation.
Is he going to make it? I am going to say yes.
Matt?
Wow. There's 5 players, I think, jostling for 2 positions. I think you've got Ruud, Hurkacz, Norrie, Sinner, probably I'd put Ojo Aliassime in there as well. A lot of points still to play for. And I think I agree completely with David's analysis there of sort of Norrie and those conditions. I think they might suit him better than Casper Ruud, though. I think Casper Ruud on a quick indoor hard court, we haven't seen that yet. I think Hurkacz will probably get in. And yeah, I think Norrie might sneak in ahead of Ruud. Based, you know, if it comes down to who gets the most points out of these next few events?
I think Hurkacz is going to be edged.
Okay.
Hurkacz won an indoor title a couple of weeks ago.
Ruud killed everybody.
I think Norrie's going to be there, whether he's qualified or as an alternate.
So we all think, in summary,
No.
Whoa. Did you just throw in alternate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's going to be,
well, Catherine.
He's going to be
there.
It's
neither here nor there. He's currently in an alternate position. That's not a prediction.
Thing is, you've got to remember, you can go backwards. Like, there's still points to play for. He could still be overtaken by Sinner. Ojo Aliassime behind him. I'm saying I don't think he will be.
I'll give you it. It's a prediction. It's feeble.
I just said he'll qualify.
Okay. Cameron Norrie
you
is going
said.
To... I was in the middle of saying, and then I heard alternate come up, and I backtracked for clarification. I think Cameron Norrie is going to qualify in the main draw of the ATP finals, and that is a wild thing to be saying. It really is.
I mean, but all credit to him. My word, has he done it?
I mean, look, frankly, even if he's only there as an alternate, that is incredible as well.
Yeah.
Even if he's not there as an alternate.
I never thought...
It's all incredible, yeah.
I mean, he's kind of 15th stroke 16th in the world, because he's on the same points as Jannik Sinner right now. And he's 10th for the year. So, no, I never thought he would ever do this in his whole career. So, fair play.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible, Cameron Norrie. And it does make it fun, doesn't it, when there's a real jostle for the last couple of spots for the finals.
It's going to be great this next few weeks.
It does heat up these last few weeks, doesn't it? The doubles titles in Indian Wells were won by Su Wei Shea and Eliza Mertens. They beat Veronika Kudermetova and Elena Rybakina. Shea and Mertens were also Wimbledon champions this year, of course. So it's nice to see Mertens still being brilliant at doubles, even though she's lost her longtime partner in Aryna Sabalenka, who doesn't want to play so much doubles anymore.
She really gets a lot out of doubles, you know, Mertens. I was listening to the press conference afterwards. The kind of the social aspect of it, she clearly makes her life better on the tour. I mean, maybe, I don't know whether it might hurt her singles career. Some players think it does, but even if it did, even if it hurt some of those results, you can tell that her life is better for being a doubles player.
And for spending a lot of time with Su Wei Shea, I reckon.
Who I think was wearing a dragon mask in one of the photo shoots, wasn't she?
She was. Not sure there was any explanation of it. And why should there be? You wear a dragon mask if you want to. More of that, please. The men's doubles title was won by John Peers and Filip Poloshek. They beat Aslan Karatsev and Andrei Rublev in straight sets in that final. First title for Peers and Poloshek, who had reached the final in San Diego the week before. They'd lost to Skubski and Salisbury in that one. So a great result for them. Now then, Matt, I can't keep the listeners teased and tantalised any longer. We have to do Cinema Corner with Catherine and Matt because it's been quite a week for tennis-related cinema. There were two tennis films on offer at the London Film Festival this year, which is brilliant. I also went to see a golf film at the London Film Festival, so excellent. More sports films, please. Matt and I last Sunday went to see a screening of Citizen Ash, directed by Rex Miller and Sam Pollard. Rex Miller was there. He did a Q&A after the screening. We loved it, didn't we, Matt? We absolutely loved it. I hadn't realised that it was made by the same directors and production team that had made the Althea Gibson documentary that I'd watched as preparation for our Althea Gibson Tennis Relived podcast. And look, we went into this in the privileged and I think unusual position of knowing a lot about Arthur Ashe because of the research that we'd all done for our Arthur Ashe Tennis Relived podcast. There were a lot of people in that audience who kind of every question in the Q&A afterwards, wasn't it, was prefaced with, I'm ashamed to say I didn't know very much about Arthur Ashe, but I do now and I feel better for it. But yeah, we knew a lot of the content and yet still it felt extremely fresh and vital somehow.
Yes, the woman to my right gasped when it was sort of revealed in the documentary that Arthur Ashe had AIDS. So yes, I think from a content and sort of biography perspective, I actually felt quite reassured that we didn't learn anything particularly new. I think if you've read up on Arthur Ashe or you've listened to our Tennis Relived show on him or you've sort of researched his life, you won't learn a great deal about the facts of his life through this film. But what you will get, and certainly the gaps that were filled in for me, were the amount of archive footage there was. And when I say footage, I mean both video, in terms of you watch Ashe play the US Open final against Tom Ocker at Forest Hills. You watch him be Davis Cup captain on the bench and trying to control John McEnroe. You watch him play Jimmy Connors in South Africa. There was amazing footage of all of those moments. There's also loads of photos that sort of help to tell the story, which are brilliant. And I think the main thing is that there's so much of Arthur Ashe's voice in this documentary. Rex Miller said in the Q&A afterwards that they had the transcripts of Arthur Ashe's interviews that he did with the writer Arnold Rampersad when he was writing his Days of Grace autobiography. They had these transcripts, and Rex Miller said, well, I don't know what we can do with these. They're amazing, but how can we turn them into a documentary? And they said, do you have the audio? You know, have you got them anywhere? And Arnold Rampersad found the audio and allowed Rex Miller and his team to digitize them. And the documentary is basically told through Arthur Ashe's voice in those interviews. So you hear him sort of narrate his thoughts and feelings at the key moments in his life, which is incredible. And I don't think you'll find that anywhere else. I think the title, Citizen Ashe, is significant. It really places Ashe as a citizen in the world, of the world, who's engaged in the world, and it sort of charts his development from sort of reluctant to get involved in the civil rights movement to doing it in his own way. That is all told brilliantly. And then there's lots of really significant people who are in it. Donald Dell is in it. John McEnroe is in it. And perhaps most significant of all, Jeannie, Arthur's wife. There's a lot of her in it as well. She knows Rex Miller, I believe, through photography. So you hear lots from her, and that's brilliant as well. And yeah, it's very well done. Quite emotional at times. Some really sad moments in it. But yeah, well worth a watch.
His brother Johnny is also in it. He's a big contributor, and somebody I hadn't heard from before. There was a moment where Johnny told the story of he was serving in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and a law was introduced during the Vietnam War as a direct response to the Second World War, when mothers' families lost all of their sons, that only one child in a family could be in active duty at one time in the war. And Johnny, I think Arthur was about 19 at the time. I think it was when he was at Stanford University. Johnny signed up for a back-to-back tour, so that Arthur wouldn't have to serve in the Vietnam War. And I don't know whether Matt could see in that moment, but I just was streaming with tears. I was triggered. and yeah, there were little moments like that just, yeah, really got me. Highly recommend watching it. They weren't quite sure if this is quite often the case with film festival films, but they weren't quite sure what the distribution would be. So I can't tell you. I mean, one of the questions in the Q&A was, where will this be available? I want to tell people to go and see this. Where can they go and see it? And I think they thought there would be a limited cinema release in the UK. I presume it'll end up on a streaming platform somewhere. I'll try and keep an eye on that so I can tip people off about where they can watch it when it does become available. I also went to see King Richard at the Royal Festival Hall. The screening of that on Friday as part of the London Film Festival. This is a biopic of Richard Williams, father, of course, of Serena and Venus, and one of the greatest tennis coaches of all time, somebody that has had a massive impact on the entire course of tennis history. Richard Williams is played by Will Smith. And I'd heard rumblings of sort of this is an Oscar-winning performance by Will Smith in the lead-up. And I'd seen the trailer, and I have to say the trailer worried me. I thought it looked really overwrought, and in particular Will Smith's performance looked overwrought in the trailer. But I was so pleasantly surprised by the film. It's not overwrought. I think it's actually a perfectly balanced performance. It's brilliant. It focuses on quite a narrow period, which I was quite surprised by. I thought it would be a sweeping epic, sort of covering, you know, the Williams story from the very, you know, the twinkle in Richard Williams' eye when he says to Orosine, we need to have two more daughters, right up until, you know, Serena Williams winning her 23rd Grand Slam. It doesn't. It focuses on quite a narrow period when Serena and Venus are both teenagers. It does have the not just cooperation, but backing of Serena and Venus Williams. They were listed as producers. And it's really, really interesting. I'm not saying that it's a definitive, unbiased telling of the Richard Williams story, but it is a rich telling of the Richard Williams story. And I do think Will Smith's performance is pretty brilliant, really. And those are words that I didn't think I'd ever be saying on the tennis podcast. So there they are.
Well, I mean, I hadn't heard your reviews of either one of those films, and I'm really excited to see both of them now. Thank you.
You're welcome. I can't tell you when Cinema Corner will return to the tennis podcast, but as and when it's required or warranted, don't you worry. We will keep you abreast of all cinematic-related developments in the tennis world. The tennis podcast overall will be back next Monday. We're going to have a Q&A special, one of our Q&A specials that we do every now and then next Monday. So if you want to submit a question for that, you can do so via our social media channels. No Thursday show this week, but of course we'll be keeping an eye on what's going on in the tennis world. We've got the ATP and the WTA Tour are both in Moscow this week for the Kremlin Cup. Emma Raducanu has pulled out of that tournament that she had been scheduled to play. There, in fact, is some reports, including by Simon Briggs, that she is currently sort of trialling an arrangement with Esteban Carril, the coach that formerly worked with Johanna Konta. So we'll keep an eye on that situation. The men's tour is also in Moscow. There's no Medvedev there, but Rublev, Khachanov and Karatsev are all playing. So we'll keep an eye on all of that, don't worry. And we'll bring you any pertinent updates at the start of next week's show before we get our teeth into the Q&A. I think that's it. No points for any of us for Zeus, Scousel, Mousel or Rogue. Some of us were closer than others. No details required. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King. Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer and top bloke, and save the best to last here because our mascot for the week is Quattro. Excellent name for an excellent dog. Quattro is a 2-year-old corgi mix, a rescue dog living in Basel, Switzerland. His humans are Alexandra and Alfredo. There is just the two most sumptuous pictures of Quattro. One of him frolicking in the Swiss mountains, just looking resplendent. And another of him in a sort of sea of tennis balls. One in his mouth, one either side of his front paw, just guarding them possessively. So hello, lovely, lovely Quattro. If you want to see Quattro content, and I'm telling you, you do, it's going to be in our newsletter, so sign up to that if you haven't already. We'll be back with another tennis podcast next Monday. Matt David, thank you. We'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.